Hurricane Dorian passes us by. Thank goodness. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect, and I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. The storm has passed us. Thank goodness. We'll take a look back and look at all of the biggest news and notes from the week with our Friday Media Roundtable. You can join us. It's 549-2937. Give us a call. Then later, celebrating the leading arts advocates of the First Coast. That's coming up. First, though, let's talk about the busy news week dominated by the storm as we welcome Emily Block of the Florida Times-Union. Good morning.
Good morning.
A.G. Gankarski of Florida Politics is here.
Good morning.
And on the line, Ann Schindler of First Coast News. Hey, Ann.
I'm here.
Hey, good to have you. Okay, it has been quite a week, everybody. And all of us in the local media ranks worked hard, but so did a lot of other people. First responders, educators, city officials, and more. Hurricane Dorian delivered, luckily, only a glancing blow to much of the state this week after spending a deadly day and a half over the northern Bahamas, devastating those islands. Now, this was a wicked storm, a record-breaking storm, with wind gusts over 200 miles an hour when it was spinning at its strongest. The good news for us is our area didn't suffer a whole lot, but we're still going to take a look back at how this region and the state responded to Dorian and how it affects some other local political issues as we take your calls. It's 549-2937. Give us a call. 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaNJax. And we'll get to some of the weird and wacky Dorian news from the week later in the hour as well. All right, Emily Block of the Times Union, let's begin with you. The city was well prepared, so was the Duval County Public School System, to shelter people. The worst impacts that we feared, luckily, did not come to pass.
Correct. So something that stood out to me is that 11 of 12 of the hurricane shelters that were used for this storm were public schools. So it brings to light, well, we were just talking about a referendum a week ago, you know, before the storm hit. So how is that going to play into the school board's argument that we need funding for the fact that our schools are hurricane shelters? The majority of the shelters in Jacksonville are schools.
Yeah, this was a living example of the importance of these schools being well-built and up to code. A.G. Gankarski, it was really remarkable, as Emily pointed out, when we saw the intersection of emergency response, local politics, and education issues. During the height of the storm, to see the mayor and the superintendent of schools, Diana Green, up there at the EOC podium together, working together as professionals to get us through the storm, even though, of course, they're on opposite sides of this really difficult local issue about a half-cent sales tax referendum for schools.
Yeah, it's an example of politics stop at the water's edge, quite literally in this case. It's very hard to get people off message, which is prepare for the storm. If you need to evacuate, evacuate. And, you know, it's kind of reassuring that despite all of the political drama that's happened over the last year and a half or so in the city, you know, these people can come together and work together during what ended up being an exhibition game in storm season. This is like Hurricane Floyd 1999, in that there are a lot of anticipated impacts that thankfully did not come to pass. We saw a lot of victory laps on the local level, on the state level, federal level. Senator Rick Scott, who could have been helping people in the Bahamas if he were serious about that, instead came to Jacksonville to do a, you know, handshake, meet and greet photo op at the EOC. Well, that's great. You know, we didn't have really tropical storm force winds, you know, west of the intercoastal. So, you know, people wanted to take victory laps here. I would say the storm season is really long. We've got two more months of this. We remember Irma and the issues it brought. October storms do happen. So I think that people could have been more muted in their self-congratulations at the end of the storm.
Ann Schindler on the line with us. You know, this was good timing for the mayor in particular. He had the opportunity to show leadership and distract or get the headlines and the attention off recent headaches that Jacksonville City Hall has been dealing with. Blowback over the push to privatize JEA, controversy over the sales tax for schools, et cetera.
Well, it's true, Melissa. There's nothing like a good crisis to kind of solidify somebody's standing. And I think, as AG pointed out, that's probably something to do with Senator Scott coming to town. He, you know, always liked to take the helm during a hurricane. But I think the long-term reality for this mayor is the impacts of, you know, climate change and sea level rise are really imperiling his city in so many ways. And, you know, his legacy in a lot of ways is going to be tied not to a specific storm, but kind of long-term resiliency.
Let's talk about that panel. You know, the city of Jacksonville has been roundly criticized, and rightly so, for being so late to the party in terms of mounting a robust resiliency response to our warming world, rising seas, more frequent heat waves, the overtopping of State Route A1A in two spots. Ann Schindler, you've been reporting on that during Dorian. The state is going to have a big headache in the years ahead as it works to maintain coastal assets, coastal properties. That is a big issue in Jacksonville. We have not only the oceanfront, but we have a lot of inland waterfront property that, as we saw during Hurricane Irma, is very vulnerable. And so what about the point she made that the city is really behind the eight ball, although it's trying to catch up, in terms of addressing how to become more resilient, how to plan for mitigation and adaptation measures when it comes to these stronger storms that are being increasingly driven by warming oceans?
Well, this is my first storm in Jacksonville. I'm used to the ones in South Florida, but something that stood out to me was the Jax Ready app. Apparently that's pretty new, the implementation of it, and it was striking as far as how efficient it actually was. I mean, it had every question answered. So I think that's a example of the city really trying to up their game and, mm-hmm. you know, move the ball forward.
Right. The blocking and tackling of disaster response, AG, the city has that down. They're very good at that.
Yeah.
But her point was about the bigger picture, the long-term issues we're looking at.
Our mitigation strategies are wholly inadequate for what's coming. And you see that in cities up and down the seaboard. Jacksonville's not unique in that, but you know, we have so much bet on evacuation zones A or flood zones A and B. Those mass evacuations out of those that were ordered that could have been necessary if the storm had, you know, toggled west, et cetera. We don't really have any long-term cohesive strategy to deal with, you know, the issues that create flooding. And of course, we have the dredging of the river, and who knows what the ultimate impacts of that are going to be. Some people forecast it's going to lead to more river rise and more, you know, water level rise that threatens these like riverfront communities. So I don't know if this mayor is going to be able to do much about it because his capital improvement budgets are baked into the cake. And the big question seems to be, do we have a new jail or not? So I think it's going to be a discussion for the 2023 campaign.
Exactly. Whomever gets into the race to succeed Mayor Curry, these questions will become ever more urgent, Emily.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't see that urgency here until we start bringing the Riverkeeper to the table, bringing salty urbanism to the table and having those conversations more seriously.
Can you explain that term a little bit for listeners,
sure.
What you
so
just
salty
said?
Salty urbanism is actually, it goes into a study that was taking place in South Florida, and it's architects and city planners working together and looking at the long-term effects of sea level rise and climate change and how to factor that into building structures, building implementations, and where people are going to live in the future.
You know, this is the fourth year in a row that we have had a Category 5 storm during the Atlantic hurricane season. Forming in the Atlantic, we had Matthew 2016, 2017 Irma and Maria, 2018 Hurricane Michael late in the season, devastating the panhandle, and now 2019 Dorian. And when you talk to climate scientists and meteorologists, they increasingly will point to the fact that climate change is a factor in exacerbating the strength and intensity of these storms, and in particular, the way the storm stalled out and moved so slowly over the Bahamas. There is a confluence of factors driving that. And slower storms that stall out, this is, to use a bad pun, a perfect storm for Florida and the Southeast, because only more of this is in our future.
Well, that's right, Melissa. And, you know, what struck me last year was that we're not just seeing stronger hurricanes. I mean, we're seeing a pattern where whole cities, whole towns are wiped off the map because of climate-related issues. We've seen Paradise destroyed. You know, mm-hmm. Mexico Beach destroyed. The impacts of Florence and the flooding in North Carolina completely destroyed some small towns. So it's almost like, and now, of course, the Bahamas. I mean, starting over entirely from a completely flattened landscape is a template we've not really seen before. It's a different kind of disaster recovery.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting to look at the politics of this in Florida, AG, where unlike a lot of other states, you've got bipartisan consensus to a point, particularly with Governor DeSantis now moving more fully into the reality of the consensus of climate scientists, that Florida has a problem. Its coastal properties are threatened. We need an aggressive strategy for how to deal with this. Are some areas going to be looking at managed retreat over time? What are we going to do for homeowners who are going to be increasingly challenged in insuring their properties, and business owners? How are we going to deal with extreme heat? This is something that Florida is slowly moving toward grappling with. Critics say not fast enough, though.
Right. I mean, we stalled out for most of this decade. We had a governor for 8 years who could not be... could not acknowledge climate change in any meaningful way and could not acknowledge mankind's role in creating that climate change. And that's really something where we're going to deal with mitigation strategies that are going to be struggling to keep up with the curve just because of the nature of, you know, of ocean temperature rise. You know, we're seeing warmer temperatures farther north and for longer. And, you know, in seeing that, we're going to see more of these storms, more of these slow-moving storms like Harvey, you know, that affected Houston, Texas, like Irma that we saw here, like Florence, North Carolina. And it's going to be devastating, and a lot of it's going to go undercovered if it happens in smaller media markets, which is the case with those, you know, a couple of those storms I mentioned. So this needs to be a budgetary priority. You know, Governor DeSantis had a promising start, but he's got 7 budgets and a recession looming. So we'll see what follows up.
By the way, as your outlet, the TU, has on its homepage, Emily, don't take your eyes off the tropics yet. More storms are out there.
We're still going.
Yeah. Yeah, lots more in the mix. Okay, it's our Friday Media Roundtable with Ann Schindler, Emily Block, A.G. Gankarski, and myself, and your calls. How'd you make it through the storm? What are your thoughts? 549-2937. Mark is on the west side. Hi, Mark. Good morning.
Good morning. You know, I've been here all my life since 1960. I remember a real hurricane, Dora, in 1964. Mm-hmm. And I don't know the solution to this problem, but I do think it is a problem. You know, we hear, you know, the buildup is a week long coming. It's doom and gloom, and every time you turn on the radio or the news channel, and you know this one was particularly long because the hurricane stalled and was so slow. But Jacksonville rarely gets hit, and I think, you know, we're going to get so much of this doom and gloom that one day we are going to get hit by Category 5, and people are going to ignore all this because, you know, it just goes on, and very seldom does it really pay off, or do we really, you know, get hurt by a hurricane. I mean, a week ago, this was, you know, a Category 5 right in the heart of Florida and right in Jacksonville.
Yeah.
And by the end of it, I've seen nor'easters, many nor'easters pack more of a punch than this so-called hurricane. But, you know, I understand that they have to you know, go aside for on caution, you know, when people's lives are at stake. But, you know, it just is the same thing every year, you know, doom and gloom, and this, it's going to kill you, and you got to be careful. And then it passes us right on by. And this time it was, you know, barely even a rustle in the wind. But for 5 days, they had everybody keyed up, ready, you know.
Sure. I get your point, Mark.
And I'm going to push back on that a little bit. I mean, a Category 5 was the forecast, right? Like, wasn't a fiction. That was what was the forecast. And so if it's predicted to come, you know, possibly to this area, and it's a 5, you have to prepare for that. I mean, the fact that it did pass us by was greatly fortunate. But, you know, I understand people get a little fatigued with it, but I don't think that you can say that that's the fault of city planners or the coverage.
Right. Certainly the city media outlets have to do everything in their power to warn the public. And I don't think anyone would fault that at all. Although I do hear what he's saying about the fact that in this community, people tend to be kind of blasé and have hurricane fatigue and think, oh, you know, mm-hmm. we, in the end, this community never really suffers. And that, honestly, that's probably a mistake to have that mindset.
Exactly. This is something journalists grapple with often, is at what point is there fear-mongering or editorializing, or are we doing what we need to do? And I think more often than not, journalists are doing their job and we're trying to keep people safe. We're putting out the message that the city is giving us and city officials and public officials. And if you look at the effects, I mean, on the other side of the bridge, there was flooding, there was storming, swimmers got caught up in currents, swimmers got lost. And I don't think there were any fatalities to my knowledge in Jacksonville, but there were close mm-hmm. calls. There were many. And then if you look over at our friends at the Bahamas, obviously they were devastated. So I don't think it's being doom and gloom. I think it's us doing our jobs and trying to keep people safe.
When you look at the footage coming out of the Bahamas, it is truly horrific. It really gives you an idea of the damage a storm like this can cause. And we are lucky, very lucky, that mm-hmm. we were spared that level of intensity.
Yeah, I interviewed a legislator from the Bahamas earlier this week, and he was on Grand Bahama Island. He was describing chaos, jet ski searches. He's trying to get enough jet skis to look for people in house to house searches. He described devastation, flooding, and there was no way to really tell how many people were dead, how many people were missing. And that is what they are dealing with for the weeks and months to come. There appears to be the beginnings of a robust American response to this. We're sending in help, supplies that are urgently needed, Coast Guard and search and rescue teams from Florida. Also, a lot of aid. So we're seeing that, and that's promising. But the Bahamas is going to need a comprehensive rebuild in many areas. Senators Rubio and Scott have petitioned the White House for visas for Bahamians with residence in this country so they can come over and actually work during this time that the Bahamas is being rebuilt. But as we see with Puerto Rico, a lot of people may petition not to go back, because if you're...
What's there to go back to?
Exactly. I mean, you're going back to something, and it's just very difficult to imagine. So, we're going to see a change in the Bahamas composition, and we're going to have to deal with these issues longer than just this next couple of news cycles. This is going to be a recurring thing.
Mark is in Mandarin. He has some thoughts about the Bahamas. Hi, Mark. How you doing?
Hello. Doing well. Thank you for having me. I heard earlier AG mentioning something about when Rick Scott visited the EOC instead of going to the Bahamas. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay. So, and I don't know what the reference, so my opinion, at least the way I took that, is that AG was being biased and assuming that Rick Scott was coming to Jacksonville was simply to overlook the needs of the Bahamas, when in fact your last...
No, let me... Showed, okay.
Well, please clarify, because otherwise I do consider you biased against Rick Scott when clearly he has been focused on the Bahamas, which is not even U.S. territory. And right. For a politician to go visit a disaster when it's in a recovery response time is inappropriate. Oftentimes they interfere with response recovery. Jacksonville is no longer. We're standing down our EOC. It is a fine time for Senator Scott to visit.
Okay, Mark, thanks for that.
What did you mean, AG?
Go ahead.
Senator Scott has made a history of using storm response to spackle over political issues. We saw it as recently as the 2018 campaign, where instead of doing the mechanics of the campaign up until the very end, where he barnstormed Donald Trump and Lindsey Graham, people like that, he was in the panhandle. Supposedly overseeing storm response. But, that gave him a cover to, while he's dropping $50 million of paid ads on Bill Nelson, to be above politics. Rick Scott is an example of a politician who tries to have it both ways, does things that people don't like, and then when storm response happens, he hypes it up, puts on the Navy cap. I mean, this is a man that did Sunday shows this week wearing a Navy cap without a suit. You don't go into a TV studio without, with a ball cap on unless you're trying to make a point. That Navy cap is a prop, and a lot of Rick Scott's storm response has been a prop over the years, and people know it.
Okay, what about the criticism of Senator Scott that he was seen by some as bigfooting the governor on this whole matter of hurricane response? We did not see Senator Rubio behaving, let's be frank, in the same manner.
Exactly. I mean, that's the thing. We have a governor. The governor was elected. And the governor has a right to do storm response as he sees fit. And Ron DeSantis has done a number of things different with storm response. FEMA funds that were locked up by the Scott administration are flowing again. This is something DeSantis has said time and time again. Bottom-up response, letting locals decide more so they avoid things like 2017's Hurricane Irma evacuation, where Rick Scott put 6.5 million people on the roads and had them drive for no reason, just to hype it up. And that is what we have dealt with for the last 8 years. And for Rick Scott, who is irrelevant in the Senate, to come down here.
Why is he irrelevant in the Senate?
Because he is a junior senator with no stroke and no allies. What has Rick Scott gotten past? Tell me. I'll wait. Rick Scott came down here and did memory lane.
But you're not biased against Rick Scott.
No, I am. Sorry, I am saying Rick Scott is a transactional, cynical politician. He uses storm response to hide things that he doesn't want to talk about. And if that's bias, so be it.
Well, what I would say is just that for Rick Scott is definitely somebody that involves himself in storms. And I think the glaring irony for anybody that has followed his administration is just the lack of attention and interest he's had in the cause of those storms.
Exactly right.
I shouldn't say the cause of those storms.
But what's driving the cause of more intense storms.
Right.
And you can hear the frustration in AG's voice. And I think that's reflected among a number of other media folks. In terms of the points he made and the challenges of covering some of these politicians, all of that said, the big story here this week is we can talk about the inside baseball of the political pieces of this, but the big story is that everybody's okay. And we do want to keep hearing your thoughts and comments here on the show. Lots of people waiting on hold.
I'll bet they are.
yes. Now you did it.
You did it, AG. You got them going.
It's like Christmas in here.
Okay. Tracy in Mandarin. Hi, Tracy. Good morning. Go ahead, Tracy. You're on the air.
Yeah, good morning. You know, the two gentlemen who called two calls before that, he was telling this was so much rah-rah, but we are very thankful the way you people prepared us. And because when Maria came, we lost our brand new car. We had a river in the back of the house, financially drained in spite of insurance paid some part of it. So we were thankful that this year nothing happened, but we were prepared. And it was tiring for the news media, but they were very nice and we are very thankful.
Thanks, Tracy. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks to everyone at the Times Union, Florida Politics, all of our local television outlets working through the storm. Ann Schindler, your own company, First Coast News, had everybody out in the field and doing a great job. Our own team here spent the night in the building, which is what we typically do in these situations. So, yeah, it's just an all hands on deck situation.
The length of the run up to this storm, I do hear people expressing fatigue about it. One thing that I think is, it was actually really fortuitous. I mean, we were lucky we didn't have this storm, but evacuating Florida, any part of Florida, is so near impossible that you almost need the luxury of 8 days prior to get people prepared, to allow them to get gas and have the gas tanks refilled and refilled and refilled so that everybody gets gas. I mean, getting this many million people on the roads and out of this state is a formidable task.
You kind of have to think back to Hurricane Floyd and what that was like. Mm-hmm. What a mess, right?
Yeah. And they don't even do contraflow here anymore.
They don't
do that anymore.
Yeah.
No. And as a South Florida girl, like to Ann's point, I've never seen a situation where we had so many opportunities to see water restocked, to see gas restocked. Mm-hmm. So everyone had a chance to load up for the worst.
Right. I mean, and we're getting tweets about this too. Here's one from Sierra. Just heard a caller raving about the so-called hurricane that didn't pack a punch and how preparation was supposedly wasted. Does he remember this so-called hurricane ruined the Bahamas and is wrecking our neighbors to the north as well? Greg tweets the show. There's no such thing as being too prepared. 20 more miles and we're talking a different outcome. Jacksonville should be proud of the local response. Here's a tweet from Jay. Why doesn't the city provide sandbags? It seems like a basic service that would have helped a lot of people in the storm. You know, the other day, Mayor Curry appeared on this program and we asked him about that. His response was that the city is just too big and far flung for Jacksonville to provide free sandbags. He's taken some criticism from the community about this. They've pointed out other cities around Florida provide this service for free. should Jacksonville change its policy and provide sandbags? What do you guys think?
I would think the consolidated government of the city would be able to. I mean, that's the idea. Consolidation is for efficiency. So,
I thought about this, though. I mean, one thing is if you do provide sandbags, the reality is next week, all of those sandbags become debris that the city has to go pick up and get rid of. It's not like people are going to maintain those sandbags or store them. I mean, most people are going to have them for a week and get rid of them. So I think, you know, the expense of providing that service probably better spent on, you know, shoring up some of our weaknesses and resiliency in this city. And the city really needs a holistic look at how we're going to be protecting entire neighborhoods from flooding, from inundation as the seas rise.
And this resiliency committee that's been studying this is going to be giving its recommendations to City Hall. The question I think a lot of us have is, will they follow the recommendations? Will they execute on this? Because some aggressive strategies are going to be recommended and they will not be cheap.
Yeah, that's an enormous question. Mm-hmm. And there's also some technologies that may help that are not necessarily as expensive. You know, you see these, what are those, like aqua guards that are, you know, they used at the Cummer, which are these sort of inflatable bladders that can provide temporary, you know, walls. All kinds of things are coming online that are a little bit more, maybe less, not less expensive, but less intensive.
Yeah. And, you know, that's the silver lining to this climate crisis. I don't know if, how many of you watched the town hall, the marathon, 7 hour long.
I was washing my hair.
Town hall the other night on CNN, where all the major presidential candidates were quizzed and in fact, sometimes grilled on how they would respond if elected president to the challenge of climate change. And several of them brought up the fact that as difficult as this is, innovation and science are racing to keep up with solutions and coming up with creative ideas like that. So that's just one small piece of this discussion, but it was something that was interesting to watch. Okay, let's go to Dave at the beaches. Hi, Dave. Thanks for holding. Good morning.
Hey, let's talk about the politics of prevention. And there are two meetings coming up that folks in Jacksonville need to attend if possible. Next Friday is the annual Environmental Protection Board meeting at UNF, and resiliency should be talked about along with mitigation of greenhouse gas pollution as well as nitrogen pollution in the rivers. Big topic. And today and yesterday, the Florida Energy Conference was supposed to happen down in Tampa, but it was postponed by Nikki Fried. But she has put focus on climate in this year's conference, and they're going to reschedule that hopefully maybe in October, November. It's in Tampa, costs you $250 to register, but strongly recommend that folks who are really interested in mitigation get down there and help create the political environment so that Governor DeSantis can learn how to prevent pollution and actually prevent pollution rather than responding to it after the fact.
Thanks, Dave. Yeah, the more the grassroots demands aggressive response, the more the politicians will react. That climate town hall the other night on CNN only happened as a result of millions of Americans demanding that it happen. And so that's a good point he makes. How will Florida push the political class hard on this as more and more people kind of wake up to what we're looking at? We're looking at sea level rise, inland flooding, extreme heat, managed retreat from the coastlines in some areas at some point. South Florida is already seeing this right now, sunny day flooding in South Florida, and homeowners looking to become climate refugees. We have an employee right here at WJCT. They see themselves as climate refugees. They came up here from Miami because their home was too close to the water. And they were getting sunny day flooding all the time. They, you know, you can't walk down the street 3 days out of four, days out of seven.
Downtown St. Augustine is increasingly getting like that itself. You know, it high tide, it is almost now a daily occurrence, which has infrastructure quality of life costs. I mean, it really is a changing city.
Yeah. Jeff in Mandarin. Hi, Jeff. Good morning. Go ahead, Jeff.
Good morning. Sorry about that. Yeah, just a real quick thing, AG, I love you. And
love you too.
The evacuation stuff is, evacuation plans are social insurance. And just like I get insurance fatigue every month when I stroke a check to the insurance company for my house. But when my house got hit by lightning and burned to the ground, I was really glad I had it. And yeah. I would just suggest that evacuation plans are exactly the same on a social level. But as tiring as they are and as much of a pain in the neck as they are, every day I was looking at the light rain and sunny skies during this hurricane, and I was thinking the same thing. But it's for the society and the city and the county, it's social insurance for them to be able to issue those evacuation orders. They're lawyering up. I understand it completely.
Thank you, Jeff.
As much of a pain as it is.
Thank you. Thanks for that.
You know, one thing I observe going forward, and we got some complaints from people who said, you know, not just the storm fatigue, but the idea that I don't have the money, the resources to build up my stores, my supplies, and evacuate. Like, going forward, if this is going to become the drill, I think that the city, in addition to working on resiliency, is also going to have to create a fund to help the, you know, 20%, third of the population that lives here at the poverty line, because their evacuation plan is really hampered by their own financial situation.
Absolutely. And let's take a moment to reflect on people that are still recovering from a couple of years ago from the flooding of Irma. The neighborhood that's gotten the most attention is on the north side, Ken Knight Drive, where the city response was slow and critics said not sufficient. There was a lot of volunteer effort that went into helping those people because underserved communities, poor communities, north side communities, they don't have the infrastructure in place to withstand the kind of flooding that we saw 2 years ago and that we could see again. And that gets into this whole new emerging discussion about climate justice. Mm-hmm. And how the most vulnerable people tend to suffer the most when we have these extreme weather events.
And climate gentrification, too, which, you know, is increasingly where you see properties that are more protected from storms, you know, sometimes displacing communities that have been there for a longer period of time. I mean, obviously, the coast has been an enviable property for a long time. But more and more, you look at Volano homes that used to be, you know, very desirable properties are now tipping into the ocean.
Right. And you're already seeing in some South Florida neighborhoods, people with means are moving to higher ground in neighborhoods that used to be seen as undesirable neighborhoods, but it's starting to flip. Higher ground neighborhoods are becoming more desirable, mm-hmm. and that is gentrifying them, and it's pushing people out of them. Mm-hmm. And that's going to escalate over time. Okay. May on the South Side. Hi, May.
Hello, how are you all this morning?
Good, thanks. How are you doing?
Hey, first of all, great job on the reporting and all the updates. And if people will get tired of hearing it, they can always turn it off.
That's true.
But great job. But more importantly, at this moment, Jimbo Stockton, who's a local well-known guy, and separately, Ponte Vedra Presbyterian Church, which I am not a member of, Ponte Vedra Presbyterian Church is asking people yesterday and today to bring their unused hurricane supplies to the church, and they have mobilized a private effort all up and down the coast for people to, they've got U-Haul trucks, they're only taking them through today for the moment. And they've got private boats and airplanes that are getting these life-saving supplies to the Bahamas. And then separately, Jimbo Stockton has an effort that I am not as familiar with to get these supplies to these people. And with the smaller boats, they can go more places. With the type of airplanes, they can go more places. And I think we should lend a hand to our Bahamian neighbors in need and welcome them and give them some dignity. They've certainly entertained us for the last decades, and we certainly need to reach out and help them in their darkest hour, which is literally right now.
Yeah. May, thank you so much for that. Yeah, and thanks for plugging the church. Kudos to them and everyone else that's doing what they can. I don't know if you guys saw this too, but the chef Jose Andres mm-hmm. single-handedly this guy is amazing, is setting up mobile kitchens throughout the islands in the Bahamas, feeding thousands and thousands of people. He did this after Hurricane Harvey in Texas. It really shows you the power of one person to make a positive impact. So for everyone out there that's working on those relief efforts, keep them coming, because as she pointed out, it's so needed right now.
And if you're interested in helping, I know the Times Union has an article on local efforts to help our friends in the Bahamas. I know that Southern Roots is collecting supplies as well.
Yeah, Bold City Church, we did a story on them last night. They're collecting supplies. I think they're located kind of on the north side. But yeah, there's a number of agencies that are banding together and you know, trying to pull together supplies. I think the problem, I mean, logistically, it's tough. You know, I understand that a lot of boat traffic is limited there right now because so much debris in the water. And obviously the planes in and out are, I mean, it's an air traffic control issue right now, just because there's so much evacuation going on. But
yeah, and here stateside, I'm looking at some of the video and images coming in from the Outer Banks and the Carolinas. Mm. It's looking bad up there as well. Emily in St. Augustine. Hi, Emily. You're on the air.
Hi, Melissa. How are you doing today?
Great, thanks. Thanks for calling.
Good. I just wanted to comment on the previous comment that you had about flooding in St. Augustine. My house got about 2 feet of water during Hurricane Matthew. So this hurricane, we took no precautions, boarded up the house, evacuated. And also after Hurricane Matthew, the first response that we saw was from the Red Cross, from nonprofits, from churches. It wasn't until maybe a few days later that we actually saw aid and response from, you know, the city. So again, do everything that you can. And after you have become, like you said, influenced personally by a hurricane, you look at the next one very seriously.
That's right, Emily. And I think you speak for so many people in the area that have fresh memories of the previous storms we've been through. And, you know, I think we're all a little hurricane weary. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, the one thing you hear from anybody that's been through a storm is that they'll never do it again. And that is the lesson that, you know, you learn. You can say that you're tired of it. You can say that, you know, you're fatigued by the buildup, but nobody ever enjoys sticking it out during a hurricane.
No, it's not a pleasant experience. Jason in San Marco has some thoughts. Hi, Jason. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. A couple things. You know, Melissa, I just want to say I do watch WJCT at home. I listen to you guys. And I take the word of the scientists in this world who describe what is happening to our climate. But you got to know, and I hope your listeners know, that there is a lot of people out here in this country who believe that the concept of global warming is a massive, quote unquote, left-wing conspiracy to gain power and control over others. And it's really sad. It's a really sad commentary on this great nation that there are so many people who don't listen to the scientists and the empirical evidence that's out there. There's so much of it. It's overwhelming. And yet there are so many people who believe that it's just a giant hoax. The other comment that I have is that I think the school board needs to have a preparation for the future, when we have more of these hurricane and these weather days, when school is canceled, the kids get assignments to do at home. My kids just had a 4-day holiday and they're celebrating. And I'm like, you know, this is a mistake.
My kids did some work at home. They did some, not a lot.
My kids didn't get anything from their teachers. They should be getting read page 7 through 11 and do the worksheet. Yeah. And they should get that every day, because we've just started the school year. We don't need a week off, and we certainly don't need a week where there's quote unquote no school.
I got you, Jason. Thank you. Yeah.
Thanks again.
Thank you for those points. Now, I hear you on both points. To his first point, let me shamelessly plug our climate website here at WJCT.
It's wonderful.
It is awesome.
Oh, thank you. It's adaptflorida.org. Please check out adaptflorida.org, which we will continue to update, looking at how Florida is challenged by a warming planet and what is being done to adapt on a number of fronts. We also, let me shamelessly plug, today at noon on our statewide radio program, the Florida Roundup, we are going to be interviewing a number of climate scientists, looking at Dorian through that climate lens and what Florida can expect in the future when it comes to major storms and severe weather. And so, again, adaptflorida.org, noon today on 89.9, the Florida Roundup. So just making those plugs because we here at WJCT always come down on the side of, as you said, Jason in San Marco, the science. Okay. And he made some comments about...
Let me get it.
What's that?
I'm ready for it.
Yeah, he made some comments about less than intelligent people. Mm. And so that really does help me lead into our look at these strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous...
Oh, but really quickly, on education, any Florida school board and school district is factoring hurricane days into their schedule the same way in the north they're factoring in snow days. So typically those weather days are made up for later on. And then to expect to get homework, I mean, some teachers might give a worksheet, but to expect it as a grade, I think is overlooking people that might have to evacuate, might lose resources, might lose power. And I don't think that's the way to go about it.
Thanks for that. Yeah, certainly that expresses, I'm sure, how the educators felt about this week. Education, get as much of it as you can. As we talk about there never being a shortage of material for the crazy and ridiculous in this state, here it is for you right now, only in Florida, the Dorian edition. Okay, where to begin? Only in Florida do people act like total idiots during hurricanes. Let's begin with the one about the Jacksonville woman that saran wrapped her house because she thought, hey, that'll keep the storm away.
Plastic makes it possible.
Brittany Vidal decided to wrap her home in heavy-duty plastic in the Davis Shores neighborhood. That was her way of riding the storm out. Had to get that REO Speedwagon reference in somewhere. Okay. Did you guys see that? I know you covered that, Ann, at First Coast News. Saw the video. Well, saran-wrapped house.
I mean, you've got to be thinking outside the box, so to speak, and that definitely is an interesting approach.
So. It's outside a lot of boxes.
What about the Jacksonville man who parked his smart car inside his house so it wouldn't blow away? Patrick Eldridge told CBS News he put the car right into the kitchen. He figured that would make sense. Then there was the guy in St. Johns County who tethered his entire home to concrete blocks and a Cadillac Escalade. How did that work out for him?
The Escalade is worth more than a house based on what I saw.
Yeah.
Then in Palm Bay, a man's video went viral as he opined that we could stop the storm with ice. Just drop it in the water, he said, and use the Navy to drive some planes around to get the winds going the other way.
Ice, ice, baby, stop, collaborate, and listen.
And last but not least, a Florida man who actually made us proud. An anonymous Jacksonville man purchased 100 generators at $450 a pop at a local Costco to donate to the hurricane-ravaged Bahamas. The photo of this happening went viral, but the man does not want his name out there. Whoever you are, nice work, sir.
And take the tax write-off.
Yes. And thank you so much for being here, guys, after a very tough week. Emily Block of the Florida Times-Union, Ann Schindler, First Coast News, A.G. Gankarski of Florida Politics. You've earned a nice weekend, so hope you enjoy it. And thanks for being here with us.
Get some rest.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
In a moment, a conversation with Joy Young of the Cultural Council of Greater Jax. We'll be right back.
Listen to Pop-Up Country on 89.9 HD4 and explore country, folk, bluegrass, and blues by the musicians who created it as we get ready for Ken Burns' latest documentary, Country Music, coming to WJCT-TV in September.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Law Firm.
I'm Wayne Hogan. Our most basic instinct is to protect our families. Safety belts and properly installed child seats do that. They prevent injuries and deaths.
Learn more at waynehogan.law.
World Affairs Council and UNF partnering to engage citizens in becoming better informed participants in the global community. September 17th, former ambassador to Panama, Barbara Stevenson. The Latin Americans, their love-hate relationship with the United States. Information, worldaffairscouncil.jax.org.
One new consumer trend? Adults paying good money to feel more like kids.
I believe that as a child, we were very happy and we did a lot of fun things that genuinely made us smile. And growing up, I think that knocks it out of you.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Do you want a timeout? That's next time on Marketplace.
This evening at 6 here on 89.9 WJCT.
Can you charge your cell phone using running water or an escalator? And how effective is tennis star Serena Williams at swatting down a drone? I'm Ira Flatto. On the next Science Friday, Randall Monroe ponders these brain-teasing questions and the science behind them. All on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon at 3 here on 89.9 WJCT.
Millions are in harm's way on the East Coast from Hurricane Dorian. Off the West Coast, questions remain after a dive boat disaster. And the country's biggest retailer stopped selling the bullets that can be used in assault-style rifles and handguns. The Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, Hurricane Dorian unfortunately postponed a number of events this week, including one called LEAP. However, the Cultural Council Arts Awards are on for this weekend, with more on that and some other news and notes from the arts world. We welcome Joy Young, Executive Director of the Cultural Council of Greater Jax. Hey, Joy.
Hey,
good morning.
Hey there, Melissa. How are you?
I'm well, thanks.
Great.
And it's good to have you on the show as we're through the storm, and there's a lot on your agenda. Let's begin with the postponements that you're dealing with, because Dorian just, you know, threw a wrench into everybody's plans this week. Bring us up to date.
Yeah, so we understand how many folks were impacted by the storm. So we elected to postpone our State of the Arts Creative Jacksonville event that was being held at UNF. That will be rescheduled. Unfortunately, we had to schedule all of the public engagement activities we scheduled. So that would have been our public art walking tour, public art bus tour, and public art bike tour.
Mm-hmm.
And as much as the public really wanted to engage, we just saw the need to postpone those. So we're looking to reschedule many of those events, Melissa.
And people need to just look at your website for updates on that.
Most definitely.
Okay. Meanwhile, the Cultural Council Arts Awards are going forward this Saturday night, and I'm looking forward to being there myself. It's going to be a great evening.
It is going to be so much fun. Of course, we are going to have opportunity to celebrate those people who have really impacted Jacksonville through the Arts Awards, through their work in the arts and culture. But we're also going to take time to celebrate. Some folks maybe have cabin fever for being inside. So we'll take time to just have fun and celebrate. I'd love to invite all of the public down to enjoy Arts Awards. Tickets are still for sale. They can visit our website, culturalcouncil.org, for tickets.
That's right. Check out culturalcouncil.org. And let's talk, too. You want to talk about emergency planning for the arts and public art projects. Those are two big priorities for you.
Right. Well, in the midst of the storm, we have to realize that our arts and cultural institutions and individual artists as entrepreneurs are affected. And I really want to point out that there are resources for our smaller organizations and individual artists. Arts Ready is an online emergency planning system that individual artists and organizations can look into to help guide emergency planning. So that's artsready.org. Another organization is the Craft Emergency Relief Fund, and that's an artist safety net, if you will. It helps craft artists prepare for and recover from personal and national disasters. And that's surfcerfplus.org. They provide excellent resources for artists, and I just want to encourage our artists, our creatives out there to take a look at those resources so that they're ready for the next storm. They're ready for the next event that happens.
That's great. Last but not least, you now have a partnership with an interesting vendor, Manifest Distillery.
Yes, we do. Manifest has been kind enough to work with us to have artist-designed bottles. They filled those bottles with their signature citrus vodka, and these bottles are one-of-a-kind creations. Folks, if you want to see some amazing artwork from amazing local artists, come to the Arts Awards to take a look at those bottles. I think there's going to be an image of the bottles and some of their creators on your website. Melissa, is that true?
Yes.
Take a look, folks. These bottles will be available for sale at the Arts Awards that are going to be happening this Saturday at 841 Prudential Avenue, formerly known as the Aetna Bottle, Aetna
it
Building.
It looks like a bottle.
Yeah. And
now the One Call Building.
Now the One Call Building. So we really would love to have you join us.
Yes. Get your tickets at culturalcouncil.org. It's going to be an incredible, very glamorous evening. The dress code is creative black tie. So if you've always wanted to get your husband out in black tie and never could find the event, well, this is one where it is happening. And, you know, I always say, if men knew how good they looked in black tie, they'd wear it every night of their lives.
Exactly. Let's see color. Let's imagine Met Gala here in Jacksonville.
Yes. So a little creative, a little flash is encouraged.
Most definitely.
Okay. I'm looking forward to it, and I'll see you there, Joy. Thanks for your leadership. Go to culturalcouncil.org for more. Thanks for being here, Joy.
Thank you so much for having me, Melissa.
And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Michelle Corum is our director. We want your feedback. Emails go to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Make sure to tune in to 89.9 today at noon for our statewide show, The Florida Roundup, as we take calls from listeners statewide on the aftermath of Hurricane Dorian, and we also interview prominent climate scientists about what Florida can expect in the future in a warming world. That's coming up today at noon. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect. If you're listening to our rebroadcast tonight, keep listening for music and have a great weekend. We'll see you Monday.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.